KYRS-LP, Spokane.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KYRS or its underwriters.
From Spokane, Washington, a production of KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, this is Take the Power.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Take the Power aims to bring you the truth by broadcasting the perspectives and asking the questions you won't hear in the corporate media. I'm your host, Mike Kress.
You know, I'm not one of those drug addicts. I am thinking very clearly.
Take the Power is the show that demands radical democratic change and the abolishment of corporate power.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful. So are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
Today on the show, Reverend Richard Lang. And later in the program, co-producer of Loose Change, version 2, Corey Rowe. Today's topic, well, first, Reverend Lang will talk to us about the convergence of right-wing politics and nationalism and conservative Christianity. And then in the show, of course, we will move at about a quarter till the hour to speak shortly with Corey Rowe, one of the producers of Loose Change, the KYRS Translator Association movie of the night, tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. Before we launch into today's show and speak with the Reverend Lang, I want to give a shout-out to Lupito and Rose, all the other DJs and volunteers here at KYRS. Thank you for everything you do. All of you are awesome. And I also want to give big props to my brothers and sisters arrested yesterday at the recruiting station in taking on the empire and taking on the military machine. Thank you for your peace work. Love you, brothers and sisters. Okay, joining me on the phone from Seattle is the Reverend Richard Lang. He is pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church in Seattle. Formerly, he was the pastor here in Spokane from 1995 to 2000 at Central United Methodist Church. Reverend Lang, welcome to Take the Power. All right.
Good
well,
stuff. It's good to be talking in Spokane again.
This is your second home, I understand.
Well, yeah, I loved my time there. You know, we did the Shalom Zone ministry downtown and got to know the Peace and Justice folks that at that time were right across the street from us. So good to be on your show. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm very glad to have you. I was referred to you actually by a caller back in January, and then I had a listener in San Francisco who sent me one of your articles. I looked more into what you were saying, and needless to say, your message definitely needs to get out there, and I know you're not alone. Before we begin the conversation, why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners a little bit about your education and your experience?
Well, I've been a pastor now. I think this is my 16th year, and United Methodist Church was a mainline denomination, and when I was in Spokane, we did a and we had a ministry, you know, right there in downtown Spokane. There are so many mostly chronically addicted single men living in the apartments down there. And so we embedded in our neighborhood and had a ministry with and amongst the poor and created a soup kitchen and a ministry that goes on to this day called the Shalom Zone, which is just a place of safety and hospitality and community building downtown. And so over here in Seattle, move churches, and I'm here at Trinity, and we have been also working with the homeless here, but I've been pretty engaged with both the fair trade movements and the peace movements, particularly, obviously, since 9/11.
I want to read our listeners a bit from a little bit of a paragraph from one of your more recent writings. And this was entitled, We Dare Not Speak Its Name. And this is what the listener in San Francisco sent to me. So I'm going to go ahead and read this paragraph. And you say, within the church, there is an irreconcilable divergence emerging. At its extremes, we see the birth of patriot pastors in Ohio, even as liberal churches become targets for IRS investigations. We see Justice Sundays and the growth of theocratic nationalism, even as more are jailed because of their faith-based resistance to the further production of war. From the pulpits of the nation, the Sermon on the Mount, Christian identification with the poor, the declaration to love our enemies are all replaced with strategies of church growth or manipulations to infiltrate political parties. Congregations insist that clergy dare not speak its name. Congregations insist that clergy stay embedded in their role as chaplain and golf partner. They insist that clergy provide comfort and offer therapeutic guidance, and clergy, with paycheck in hand and a desire for career advancement in heart, oblige their congregations with false words of peace, peace. Pretty strong words, Reverend Lang. What is this?
Well, I think that there is a crisis, totally across our country, obviously, but also within the church. And I suppose all of us, look at reality from our points of view, and mine is in the church. And the things that I see emerging is in our country and in the American nation. Particularly, there has been a fusion and a partnership established between the neoconservative movement and, of course, the Christian right wing. And I call this Christian fascism. And how it plays out in the church is that, at least in the mainline church, the clergy are simply silent, just silent, about what is happening across our country, both the lies that led into the war, the discrepancies and contradictions of the official 9/11 story, the tragedy of this war, both what it has done to Iraq, what it's doing to our nation, certainly what it's doing to the soldiers, the systematic abuse of prisoners, torture being a policy that has been set from the White House on down. And it's as if these issues, I can go through a long litany that I'll spare the listener to, but the church is silent on these matters, and that's what led to that article that you just read from, is that the abdication of the mainline clergy from speaking what in the Bible is called a prophetic word, not just a power, but an enabling prophetic word to their congregations, because I think the people in the pew need to get out into the street. The sanctuary needs to move to the street, and not simply in street theater in terms of demonstrations and so forth, and also not just in writing a letter to your congressperson. But I think the crisis that is upon this nation is such is that we need to begin to train and teach our congregations the skills and techniques of civil disobedience, much like what happened in the civil rights movement of the 50s and the 60s.
Wherein the afflicted were we're bringing discomfort to the afflictors, basically.
Well, yes, and also I think in our time the one big difference is we're bringing discomfort even to ourselves. One of the reasons that the mainline church is so silent is because there's still enough goodies being passed around. The mainline churches are predominantly middle class churches, and certainly nothing wrong with being middle class. I think it's probably what most of us subscribe to, what we want for ourselves and what we'd want for the poor, and an increase in living and standard of living and the benefits of life. However, the downside of a middle class lifestyle, literally, because it's caught between the middle of opulence on the top and the great fear of poverty on the bottom. So the middle class often is just neutered. It remains silent. It won't give a critique to what is happening in our society. And as I see it, that top 1%, top half of 1% of our nation is simply beginning to grind the face of the poor into absolute hopelessness and despair. And the middle class, I think, consciously or unconsciously, knows that they are losing ground, and they're very fearful. And so they don't want to rock the boat. It is at this point we still have a window of opportunity to basically organize power against that fascist movement that is really originating from the top of the wealth spectrum in America.
So I hear what you're saying, that the middle class, instead of rocking the boat and taking a stand and changing the way things are, in order to not lose the comforts to which they become accustomed, are in denial or are remaining silent.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and before I want to get more into the details of what you're talking about, but for our listeners who hear the term Christian fascism and just sort of blanch or have a wall come down, could you define what you mean by Christian fascism?
Well, yeah, maybe I can do that in a couple ways. The first is just strictly a definition. Is fascism is in a fascist state, what happens is all the spheres of power collapse into one, and the genius and the great pride that I think most of us have in America is that the power from the get-go was created as to be diverse, spread over different sectors, and you know, you can make the argument that elites have always had bits of power, and the people have always tried to have a little bit of that power, but even the elites were in a sense opposed to each other, and so you had checks and balances between the legislative, the executive, and the judicial branches, also in the media, also in the military. Fascism, and certainly in commerce. What fascism does is it consolidates all the spheres of power into one. Mussolini called it corporatism, the great corporate state. And I would contend that nothing will happen in any nation, really, but certainly not in America, without the blessing of the sacred. And in America, the sacred is defined through the Judeo-Christian worldview. It doesn't mean that you have to be a Christian or a Jew. It's just that is the sacred narratives that has defined the American project. And so when I talk about Christian fascism, what I'm essentially saying is that the fascism that's being generated and produced in our country today has to have a sacred legitimation, and that sacred legitimation has to come from the churches. And how that has happened in my opinion, the way I tell the story is looks something like this. In the late 60s, a great fear spread amongst the elites, and it spread amongst the elites because democracy was breaking out throughout the nation.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the days of the the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, and the consumer rights movement, amongst others, and of course the anti-war movement.
Right.
And at that time, Judge Lewis Powell, and for your listeners, a fun little project is just Google Powell memo. It's just a small little one-page memo. He had been nominated or went on to serve in the Supreme Court of Nixon, but he was living next to the head of the Chamber of Commerce at the time in their elite neighborhood. And Powell authored a memo that was sent out to not only the Chamber of Commerce's across the nation, but also the corporate heads and conservatives. And essentially what Powell was saying is that we of wealth, we of means, need to take back our country. We need to begin to pour resources into particularly academia, but also in the creation of think tanks and parallel institutions to make this a more pro-business environment. And from that came the right-wing infrastructure, the Heritage Institution, the American Heritage Institution, the Cato Institution, and so forth.
Right.
How that has played out in the churches is, as their thinking developed and as this infrastructure was being put together, they realized that who's really going to be the troopers? Who's the people in the street that generate and drive this movement? And they began to funnel money into agencies, for example, the Institution on Religion and Democracy. And the purpose of those institutions was to infiltrate primarily mainline not only congregations but mainline church structures, and to move their witness away from prophetic social justice, social and economic justice issues. And once again, if people want to read a little bit, the Institute on Religion and Democracy is still around. one of their primary spokesperson is an ex-CIA agent named Mark Tooley. It was one of the great founders of it was a guy named Penn Kimball, who was part of the matchmaking operation between Oliver North and the financial backers of the Contras. And all of this, we're talking millions of dollars being funneled into agencies for the purpose of tearing down primarily mainline church social and economic justice witnesses. And this, to me, this is a another indication of that what's happening in the country is not just a series of unfortunate incidents, but that you very much have a strategy and you very much have people behind that strategy that are very clear that the sectors of power need to merge into one.
If you're just joining me today on Take the Power, my guest is the Reverend Richard Lang. He is the pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church in Seattle, and we are discussing Christian fascism. I totally follow what you're saying here, Reverend Lang, because, like you said, democracy was probably for the first time in our nation's history was truly breaking out in the late 1960s, and the elites got very concerned and then built this infrastructure to which you were referring. And along those lines, about what you were saying with the changing the structure of the church and moving churches away from social and economic justice, and you know, essentially following the true message and spirit of Jesus Christ. How, you know, I mean, does this explain why, you know, in the 1960s we had a church community that was very involved with the concerns of everyday people, and now today we see a church that totally ignores these issues? I mean, I know clergy right here in this city that have said, I don't care too much about the homeless people because you know, there's nothing you can do for them.
Right. There's a whole sphere of of issues there. One is certainly the atrophying of what is called Christian discipleship, and the confusion amongst Christians as to, I guess in a sense, the primary loyalty. If, for example, when you walk into a church and you look up at its sacred space, its altar piece, you know, a very basic and legitimate question to ask is, what the heck is the American flag doing up there? It can't help but confuse what and who you're worshiping and where your primary ethical values and worldview stems from.
Right.
And a problem that does plague the church is this identification of church and state. And again, that's nothing new. It's been that way since Constantine. But what is interesting to me is, again, researching a little bit of what happened in Germany and how the Nazis also took over the churches in Germany. I don't want to use the word frightful, but it's just so illuminating to even see images, photographs of German churches in World War II, you know, draped with the swastika and draped with the Nazi flag, and how during the rise of the Nazi Party members were encouraged, and certainly soldiers were encouraged to literally flood the churches, move into the churches, and the pastors and priests began to preach a much more muscular view of Jesus, you know, Jesus as the holy, righteous warrior, agent of divine wrath, and that if you don't fall into line, you know, you're going to be crushed. And so the Jesus of the Sermon on the Mount, who is one who is willing to embrace the sorrows and sufferings of others for the purpose of changing consciousness and bringing about a system of equality, that Jesus kind of goes out the window. And one of the little phrases I run around and talk about is, in America, whoever controls the interpretation of Scripture will control the fate and the future of this nation. And it's either going to be the good news, the gospel of Pat Robertson, or the good news, the gospel of Martin Luther King. And I think that is a tremendous conflict within the churches today. And in Spokane, you know, again, I have lived there for 6 years. I believe it's a great conflict even within the Spokane churches, which, at least when I was there, were predominantly conservative anyway. They moved towards the notion of a theocratic type gospel with a very strong, muscular Jesus defending the American flag and the American way of life, as if that is a reflection of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount.
Well, that's certainly very illuminating. I think what you said, particularly about the co-opting of Jesus and defining Scripture, you know, when I talk to people, I often say, you know, Christians appear to be two camps. There's the Old Testament Christians and there's the New Testament Christians. And the way that you can tell the two apart is that when you say that this war in Iraq, for example, is totally immoral and, you know, violates everything that Jesus talked about, they pick out that little phrase about, you know, I come not to bring peace but a sword.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
On most religious media broadcasts, radio and TV, you know, George Bush is synonymous with good, and Muslims and Bill Clinton are evil, and flag-waving patriotism is akin to godliness. What do you say when you talk with people who hold these views?
Oh gosh, you know, where do you start? Which, I mean, that's a great question, because it's a very appropriate question, because it happens all the time to us, including myself, even within our own family structures. You know, for example, last Thanksgiving or two Thanksgivings ago, I was just dreading being with my extended family, because they are very much, my wife's side of my family is very much pro-Bush, and, you know, they still think this Iraqi war is a wonderful thing, and that George Bush himself is a man of God. And, you know, it's like we're living in two completely different universes. And I guess two things. I mean, one is again, to continue to lift up simply the curious questions of, I just didn't, you know, to say things like, gee, I didn't know that Jesus was a divine warrior who encouraged us to pick up guns and kill our enemies. I thought he said, love your enemies. I mean, you can play those kind of games, and you can play the games of Scripture, one Scripture against another. For myself, I've tried to grasp again a little bit of the history of what's happening in our country, but also a little bit of doing a little bit of research of what's happening in the church. And in the and just as a sidebar here, in all Scriptures, there are various narratives. And so, for example, in the Scriptures I'm most familiar with, the what's called the Old and New Testaments, there are narratives of holy war. And these are narratives where basically God is used as the justifier to, you know, wipe out everybody who's an infidel, you know, every man, woman, gnat, rat, dog, kill them all.
Right.
And in the name of God. And then there's these other narratives that critique that and say, no, that's not the way to go, that we need to have compassion, we need to have kindness. And these, this is the same, you know, this is both in Old and New Testament Scriptures, and we need to establish justice. And justice is established by equaling, by making level the economic playing field. What is of interest to me is that Jesus never, ever draws on the holy war narratives in any of his sayings. He draws upon, the prophetic statements. He never draws upon the holiness narratives. In other words, the building up of, you have to be so completely righteous that you can never compromise yourself. As a matter of fact, he does just the opposite. He has great compassion on sinners and on the outcast, those who religion condemns. So again, when I'm talking with fellow Christians who bring out the muscular Jesus, you know, I like to talk about that, is that Jesus seems to draw on the prophetic and compassionate and liberation themes of Scripture, but he's pretty silent on these holy war narratives and on the holiness narratives, living a contradiction of those holiness narratives.
Well, you make a good point, because, you know, if, when I watch, you know, Trinity Broadcasting Network and these preachers with their big gold rings and their $3,000 suits, and or if I listen to the radio, you know, I think to myself, you know, that their Jesus would be sitting down with the Pharisees and, you know, hanging out with Pontius Pilate, you know.
That's right.
So, okay, there's a – or you wrote a letter to George W. Bush back in May of 2002, and I think it was rather forward-looking. And I'm just going to read a little bit here for my listeners, a small part of it. In this letter to President Bush in May 2002, you wrote – do you really think the few crumbs of bread airlifted to Afghanistan shield the reality that you have no intention of assisting in building a sustainable society there? Is this how Christ taught you to avenge the wrongs done unto you? I am troubled by your spirit, George. You claim you are of the sustainer of life, but you practice the terror of death. You are spreading the war. Afghanistan is only the beginning. Military presence crops up worldwide. You bait us with Iraq and shield what you are doing in Colombia. You lay the groundwork for disrupting Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina. You allow the dogs of capitalism to sink their teeth into the battered body of a raped Central America. The buck stops on your desk, George. Is this what Jesus would do? What is your assessment, Reverend Lang, of Bush now? And what? And do you think things would be different without him?
Yes. Let me do the second one. Yes. I believe that November of 2000, we had a coup d'etat in this country. I think that was very much a fixed election. The Supreme Court, you know, obviously fixing it.
Right.
For George, and I also believe that the last election was fraudulent. I think the Ohio vote was. Was the Florida of the 2004 election. But I think these are nasty people in office. These are not conservatives by any means. I don't think that they're really indicative of the Republican Party. What is astonishing is how much of a hypnotic trance that this country has slipped into, and how good conservative Republicans who always believed in balanced budgets just kind of threw that out the window, much like Christians throwing Jesus' Sermon on the Mount and loving your enemies out the window whenever there's a war at hand. Hmm. This, on the one hand, it's a level of unbelievable hypocrisy, but on the other, you know, I like to think of it as a hypnotic trance. It's like what happened to the German people. They kind of project stuff onto Hitler. They've kind of fallen in love with these little petty tyrants that have great promises and somehow have this kind of charisma, and people fall in line. And that is certainly what has happened to George Bush. The Christian right's embrace of Bush as a Messiah-type figure, of a man of God, anointed of God, is very well documented. And I think, to some extent, I think he probably believes it a little bit of himself. In the Scripture, There is a notion of something called an antichrist, and the end times Christians, and that's Christians who believe that life is really a script and that the Bible predicts everything that's going to happen and that we're living in the very end of history right now. They trot out this figure of the antichrist, which is just kind of Jesus in reverse. He's the embodiment of Satan, and that he will take over and rule the world. But actually, in Scripture, the word Antichrist is mentioned four times, and it's always mentioned in 1 John and 2 John, two very, very small letters in the New Testament. But what's interesting about that is that the Antichrist of 1 John is not a person. It's a spirituality. It is something that emerges from the church. And in that sense, theologically, in that sense, George Bush is of the spirit of the Antichrist, if I was doing a theological critique. He is parading, and certainly his administration props up this great Christian veneer, when actually the policies, the worldview, the impact of what his actions are, I think, bordering on the demonic. And all I mean by that is they border on death. Everything this man touches ends in death. And you know, my real spiritual question at this point is, at what point can we no longer continue having dialogue or conversation or hoping that perhaps a political party, whether it's the Democrats or others, or even the Republican Party, could revive and bring some balance to our country? At what point do we say, my gosh, we've reached a crisis point, and we all just need to go out and shut down, you know, the I-90s and the I-5s, and shut down commerce and shut this country down, and general strikes all across it, until, you know, we get the attention focused that, you know, this country has been hijacked by cruel and evil people. So,
if you're just joining me, my guest today is Reverend Richard Lang from, he's pastor at the Trinity United Methodist Church, and I have to say, Reverend Lang, those were powerful words, and you gave me goosebumps down my spine, because, you know, when you look at the policies and the actions of the Bush administration, certainly more than any in our history, they have done nothing but bring death and destruction to the earth and its people.
Yes. There's blood all over this administration. And one practical thing that I wish the church would unify on, it should unify, it should be across the board. This is almost a no-brainer to me. The church almost universally, every mainline church, including the Roman Catholic Church and several of the conservative churches, but not the evangelicals for the most part, but every historical mainline church condemned the Iraqi invasion as an unjust war. At that point, the church should have counseled and insisted that Christians who are in the military stand down their orders. And that ought to be the word from the church today. A twofold word is that it is immoral to join the military because of the of how the military is being used by this government, and secondly, that if you have found yourself in the military for conscious sake, thinking that you know you joined because you believed that the military really was a police force and it was a force for good, but now it has now been unleashed as a preemptive warrior force invading nations across the earth. That the church should be front and center and being very vocal and active in helping soldiers leave the military, and if they're stuck in it, to stand down their orders and to have civil disobedience even within the military, which would mean that the churches would have to support those soldiers who then are arrested, imprisoned, and hounded down. But as you know, I know of no leadership in any church that has called for that. But we are sending out our troops, we are sending out soldiers to fight these immoral wars, and the consequence of that is going to be staggering, because what they are doing, how they are fighting and doing this war, when these soldiers come back to our country, they are going to be deeply, deeply spiritually, emotionally wounded. And that's on top of the thousands and thousands that we really don't hear much about who are coming back physically wounded. And as you can see, this particular government has no love for the military. They're not pouring resources into the care of our troops and their families, much less the care even of the equipment that they send them out to kill in our name for. I wish, on a very practical level,
Reverend Lang,
take that front and center.
I'm sorry, I missed your last sentence there.
I just wish that the church would be much more front and center on making that a proclamation, because I think that is a word that the church needs to speak to the state today.
Well, I'll tell you what, Reverend Lang, the next time I come out there to visit my friends in Seattle, I am going to be sitting in your congregation. Let me get your opinion on compulsory worship in the military, because we've had several recent stories. For example, at the Air Force Academy, there's a strong Christian, evangelical Christian element that dominates the school, and makes other people of different faiths feel unwelcome and uncomfortable. And, you know, when I was in the military, we were forced to go to church during basic training. It was either go to church or stay behind in the barracks and clean the floor with a toothbrush.
Right.
And out in the field, in Iraq and Afghanistan, but particularly on the battlefield, there are evangelical officers, or I should just say Christian, strong officers that claim a strong Christian faith, who compel their troops to worship and to pray a certain way. Can I get your comment about that?
Well, you know, I think, you know, let's give three cheers for the human spirit and the basic decency of human beings. It's very difficult to get most people to kill someone, to slit their throat, to torture them. It's very difficult to get human beings to believe that killing other human beings is going to resolve, is going to bring reconciliation and justice. And so what militaries throughout history have done is they have to make all war holy war. They have to attach some sort of sacred to it. People aren't going to go sign up and go and kill for Halliburton and Bechtel. But they will kill for God and country. They will kill for freedom. They will kill because they sense that Iraq is going to shoot a nuclear missile over into America and kill their family and friends and so forth. So they will kill by being manipulated through absurdities of self-defense, and at least in this case with Iraq. But on top of all of that is the necessity to create sacred legitimation for the killing. And so the military, you'll even notice this in the chaplaincy of the military. You're not going to get chaplains that stay in the military that critique war. At some point, they are totally silent, or they're totally pastoral, and it's a very difficult job. And I want to lift up that I have respect for military chaplains, because they're dealing with intense life and death, raw emotion issues every single day. However, the downside of their job is they can never critique the policies that are happening to these soldiers, and so the chaplains are co-opted by the military, and they become servants of Caesar rather than servants of Christ, is perhaps a, you know, to pop it in Christian rhetoric. And this is nothing new. This is nothing new with the Bush administration. But boy, it is really being escalated. And you're right. I mean, it is coming out, not just with the Air Force academies, but others, of how evangelicals, in particular, kind of this muscular right-wing Christianity, is just dominant in the military. And more the mainline is also losing influence over the military. And that's a dangerous trend. Catherine Eureka, again, for your listeners, Eureka is spelled with a Y, Y-U-R-I-C-A, EurekaReport.com, I think. If not com, it'll be org. Anyway, she's done some work on this, and I would encourage you to go to her website, Eureka.com or .org, Eureka Reports.
Okay. We just have about a minute left. So for those who are listening and, you know, are saying, right on, preach it, where do we go from here?
Well, it depends on who's listening. For those who are parts of congregations, I think some conversation, not simply with the pastor whose hands are often tied, but with other laity. The church, within the church, there is a wealth of wisdom and tradition of how to resist empire and how to resist the spirit of militarism. And I would encourage Christians to not settle for a therapeutic gospel, but our time calls for a higher purpose, and it calls for greater risks and more holy boldness in terms of our prophetic witness for peace and justice. For those outside of the church, I would hope, and again, for those in the church, I would hope that we would begin to much more establish networks of communication and cooperation and partnership between the environmental movement, the fair trade movement, the anti-war movement, the churches. We will need each other, because this administration is not going to give up power, and it's going to have its power removed from it. And that is going to require the organization of people power to take back our country, essentially. And so that's an area.
Reverend Richard Lang, thank you so much for being on Take the Power today. I would really like to have you on again in the future, and I'm serious about that. When I come over to Seattle, I would like to meet you and have more in-depth discussion about some of these topics we've talked about.
Well, if I may, I'd just like to put a plug in for our website, because that's
right
also a place for resources, information of at least how One Peace and Justice Church is dealing with this. And the website is TumSeattle, TUMSeattle.org. And so that might be a place for people to go for some resources.
Outstanding. Thank you, Reverend Lang, and good luck to you, and God bless you, and keep doing the good work that you're doing, and don't stop.
Thank you.
And that was the Reverend Richard Lang. And we're going to be taking a short musical break while we give the Reverend, correction, producer of Loose Change documentary a call, and then we'll be right back and talk with him for a few minutes by phone. You're listening to Take the Power. I'm your host, Mike Kress. Are listening to Take the Power on KYRS Thin Air Community Radio. That was The Church with a song called Destination, and boy, I tell you what, it was great talking to Reverend Lang. Very refreshing to hear those sorts of comments and that kind of economic and social consciousness from the clergy. On the phone with me from New York is the producer of the Loose Change documentary, the documentary on 9/11 that will be showing here at the Community Building tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. That's at 35 West Main. Your $5 donation gets you in to see the film and free popcorn, and also helps pay for the translator on which you're listening to your radio station. Corey Rowe, thanks a lot for being on Take the Power.
Hey, man. Thanks. I appreciate it.
I Googled you because I wanted to get some more information about you, and I found this. You're a Army veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq, and I found this article in from the Daily Star about you that was written July 23rd, 2002, and I'll just read a couple little parts of it here. He enlisted in the Army late in August 2001 and had just begun basic training at Fort Benning in Georgia when the September 11th attacks happened. A mere 4 months later, he found himself stepping off a plane in Kandahar. Rose's father, Tom, describes being scared for his son. "There were quite a few sleepless nights," he said. "We didn't know where he was all of the time." Corey said, although he never feared for his life, he was scared at some points. "Sometimes when you're sleeping at night, they'd jolt you awake and tell you to get in the foxholes because someone 200 meters away was getting fired at," Rowe said. "You're scared, but you're trained for it." He said some soldiers in his unit had confirmed kills of the enemies during firefights, though he had none. And your father said, Tom Rowe, he said, "Since 9/11, when we were invaded, Corey's mom and myself had mixed feelings. But after talking to Corey for a while and realizing that Corey was 100% behind what he was doing, it was a little better. The biggest change in his son," Rowe said, "has been mentally. He has matured immensely," he said. "6 months in Afghanistan has shown him how some people in other parts of the world live." Corey Rowe agrees. "The military is probably the best thing I've ever done for myself," Corey said. Corey, how did you get from being a gung-ho support the invasion of Afghanistan soldier to take revenge for 9/11 and to say in this article terrorism has to be dealt with, to the point where you produced this eye-opening and important documentary about 9/11?
Well, pretty much it was the Bush administration, President Bush himself, and the movie Loose Change. I wasn't always a part of Loose Change in the beginning process. It was solely the brainchild of Dylan Avery, the writer-director of the movie. It wasn't until I got back from Afghanistan and they started the pre-war buildup for Iraq, stating that weapons of mass destruction were in Iraq and stating that Saddam Hussein had links to Al-Qaeda. It wasn't until that I had gotten back from Afghanistan and just gone over there for 6 months and fought on the front lines, invaded the country, and took it over and was trying to reestablish it. And when I got back, we had 7 months to refit before we were getting shipped out again for an unknown length of time for a tour of duty in Iraq, where we staged on the border of Kuwait and Iraq. When I had gotten there, there was troops already there. 3rd ID was already on the border and had been there for 10 months. It was obvious that we knew we were going into Iraq far before they tried to start to the propaganda for it. About that time, it started to dawn on me that maybe there might have been an ulterior motive, maybe something else that they were trying to get accomplished in the background. It wasn't until I had read the script and seen some of the work that Dylan had done on Loose Change that I started to connect the dots that maybe it really wasn't what was going on. And then the straw that broke the camel's back was crossing the border into Iraq and clearing from the southern border to Baghdad and seeing everything that was going on. I mean, we were clearing buildings that were already demolished from the 1991 invasion. I mean, there was no one there. There was no enemy. I mean, and anybody who was there just ran. They wouldn't deal with us. We took over the country and we sat there. And that was when, you know, things started to be like, okay, we're in Iraq. I was in Afghanistan last year. Now I'm fighting another enemy here and sitting there and not really doing anything. And then starting to read the articles on 9/11, that it really started to click. And then when I first saw the addition of Loose Change, it all came together, and I really started to see the ulterior motives that were going on behind the scenes.
If you're just joining me on Take the Power, my guest by phone is Corey Rowe, producer of Loose Change Version 2. And no disrespect to Dylan. I hope he didn't take my wanting to talk with you about this as a sign of disrespect, because Dylan has produced a piece of work that I think is changing what is happening out here in America, and people are having revelations much like you had. Can you tell our listeners how you felt? You know, what was going on inside of you when you started struggling with this? You know, when you started going over this line of believing everything you've been told to realizing that what you had been told?
Yeah. It was numbing. I mean, it numbs you, and it's really hard to get passive, especially being in the position that I was, being in the military, being alongside other men who solely believed in Bush and on our agenda in Iraq. And I mean, it was very, very, very difficult, and it took a long time. But once I was on the other side, there was not much left in anger, and the fact that I had to do something about it, that I had to step forward, and I had to try to talk some sense. I mean, I even gave loose change to my military commanders. I didn't get much of a response from them on it, but I did make them aware of what I was doing and how I felt, and it was a struggle. It was a struggle my last year trying to decide and what course I wanted to go with on my life, if I wanted to continue to serve the military, or if I felt that I could do something better by starting to really produce Loose Change, and I really feel I made the right decision on that, because as you said, Loose Change is changing America, and it's changing the world. It's changing the minds of people, young and old, and it's just a matter of time before America realizes the injustices that are going on behind the curtain and really step forward. And I mean, for September 11th, 2006, we're trying to rally hundreds, if not thousands, of people to go there, all wearing a black T-shirt stating "Investigate 9/11." That we are going to produce and hopefully be able to fund and distribute this year, so that we can make our presence known, that we can know, so we can make the 9/11 community known at Ground Zero this year.
Right on, Corey. And I, you know, when I left the military in 1994 and then got out as a conscientious objector, when I went in, I was like you. I believed everything I was told, and you know, I was 17, and you know, but then after serving in the Philippines and then doing two tours over in the Middle East in the Persian Gulf region, being on the leading edge of the empire, you know, it's only a matter of time before a soldier, a sailor, an airman, a marine sees the reality and compares it to the rhetoric and what we see on TV. How did your parents, when you brought this to them, how did they feel? How did they react?
They reacted about the same way I did. I mean, they took it at value, and it made sense to them. And to my father, it made sense. He said that I brought up a lot of logical questions that needed answers that didn't make sense to him. My mother took a little bit more with. She wouldn't even really accept it at first. But over time, as most people do, the information sinks in, and they start to connect the dots by reading the daily newspapers and just seeing the news and starting to see that maybe there really is this agenda that we're not seeing. I mean, it was hard for them at first, but they're 110% behind me now. They do everything in their power that they can to help me.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Corey Rowe, producer of Loose Change Version 2. Are you guys working on a Version 3?
We're working on a few things. You know, we have some ideas. I mean, I'm not going to say the Loose Change Second Edition is, as it is, very, very good. It still needs work, and we're always doing research on the topic, and we're always receiving new information. Most likely you'll see another edition out within the next 6 to 10 months. But for right now, Loose Change Second Edition is our focus. You know, we're pushing it, and we're taking in sales, and we're giving them away to family members. And I mean, Google Video, if anybody wants to see it who's listening right now, go to video.google.com and just type in Loose Change Second Edition. I mean, it's copyright free. You can go ahead and make copies and give them to friends and hold screenings. You don't need our permission. Just, you know, go out and do it.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I respect and admire what you and Dylan and what's the other guy's name?
Jason Burmes.
Jason, have done here is that this is totally not about, you know, filling your pockets. This is about informing people about something that everything that we see in the world today, all the actions of the Bush administration, all the policies, all the unconstitutional laws and executive orders, all of it is being justified by 9/11. And, you know, what do you see going on in the future? I mean, you know, I'm not asking you to look into a crystal ball and predict it, but, you know, I mean, where do you see things going?
Well, there's two answers to that question. There is good will prevail or evil will prevail. Either America takes what they know now. I mean, the people who see this video and they spread it, and it takes America to know. And once America knows, it is time for us to stand up and tell the people that represent us, not the people that we work for, the people that work for us, our senators and our congressmen, it's time to get them doing what they're supposed to be doing. And, I mean, impeach this president and get him out of office. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, Clinton, as much as I don't even support Clinton, he got impeached for a sexual indiscretion. We have a president now who has broken over 110 laws that, I mean, and that's just like what one person has counted. He's spying on Americans, the Valerie Plame affair, the legal wiretapping, the false intelligence. I mean, it's endless. I don't think they've told the truth about anything. It is time for Americans to stand up and make this country change for the better and get a leader in there, not get a leader, but get leaders in there that we can trust and will represent the American people.
Right on. And one last question, Corey. Are there any politicians on a national level, like you were just saying that you were calling for, are you aware of any that are seriously looking at and calling for an investigation?
Absolutely, absolutely. Senator Cynthia McKinney, she is heading up. She is out there. She has called Donald Rumsfeld on the floor. I mean, she has gone out and she has publicly, I mean, as much as she can, come out and said, you know, 9/11 was an inside job and the investigation needs to be reopened. The 9/11 commission was a joke. This investigation is not over. The family members are not satisfied with the results of this commission. I mean, Cynthia McKinney is out there and she's leading the way as far as senators and congressmen who are doing something. There are others behind her that are definitely stepping up, and we actually have been in touch with a few, and we're getting there. We are making progress, leaps and bounds in progress. I mean, our website in the last 2 months has gone from 500 hits a day to 20,000 hits a day, and the word is spreading. I mean, people take the Google link and put it on their website, left and right, MySpace. I mean, everyone has the Google link for Loose Change Second Edition. It's astonishing.
Well, right on. Corey Rowe, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. I want to talk to you guys more in the future, get all of you on the phone after the movie shows here in Spokane, 6:30 p.m. tomorrow night, 35 West Main, the community building. I want everybody to bring their family, their friends, their brothers, their sisters, their cousins, their teachers, their students, and come and see this movie that Corey and Dylan and Jason have produced. It is eye-opening, it is important, and you got to set your minds free. Corey, thanks a lot for being on Take the Power. And if you have any questions or comments, give us a call here, 747-3807. You've been listening to Take the Power.